Hello and welcome to the Ether Podcast. I'm Laura Thurston Goodrow, and today we're pleased to visit with Colonel Dave Blair, PhD, author of An Anthem of the Long War, Recollection, Learning, and Looking Ahead in our fall 2023 issue, dedicated to the topic of moral injury. Dave is the director of the Chief of Staff of the Air Force Strategic Studies Group. He's an AC-130 pilot with three tours in Iraq and an evaluator pilot in the MQ-1 and MQ-9, where he deployed to Afghanistan and Africa. He studied irregular warfare under Ash Carter at the Harvard Kennedy School and wrote his Georgetown PhD dissertation on competitive innovation in international relations. He served as plank holder commander of the 65th Special Operations Squadron at Hurlburt Field in Florida, as well as in a strategy role in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and at AFSOC. He speaks Russian and lived for a time in Kharkiv, Ukraine. Dave is a proud husband to a former federal agent and proud father to the world's most mischievous toddler. Welcome to the podcast, Dave. I want to hear about the toddler.
Hello. Hey, thank you so much for having me. And really, thank you for putting together that really amazing issue. I think moving for me to just be in conversation with you and, you know, the other authors on this topic kind of brought me back to a lot of places I probably needed to think about a little bit more. So really, really appreciate that.
Well, as I've told other folks involved with it, it was definitely an honor for me to kind of help put that together. Anyway, we appreciate your contribution to it for sure. So first, I want to have you tell the listeners about your background.
Okay, well, thanks for asking. I think there's a couple different ways to see that. Really, the central point of the article is sort of dealing with killing and to some extent with being adjacent to dying. But mostly for me, it was thinking about, you know, the use of force, or more bluntly, you know, just interactions with life and death. And so I think in terms of background, coming out of pilot training, this is more or less right after September 11th. I actually wrestled with whether or not I wanted to go to grad school to see if I could get downrange earlier. And I received some excellent advice from a mentor that was more accurate than I think I could have known at the time, which is, you know, this thing will still be around. You should go to school and then get here as soon as you can after, which was essentially my story. So I went to pilot training. I was extremely fortunate to be able to go straight to AC-130s, which is a pretty amazing community. And about 2 weeks after a check ride, I was downrange. And so I think from there, once again, learned a whole lot, you know, nothing but great things to say about the gunship community. And then there was a call to go fly the MQ-1, which was frankly the best move I would have never made. And so I ended up heading out there, and it was actually a pretty amazing fit. It was a community that was trying to work through a lot of emerging technologies at the time and really a lot of emerging conceptions of what is it to fight and, you know, all those pieces. And I found myself in a place where I think I'd like to believe I had something to offer in terms of thinking about hard problems and thinking through those things. And in that, I was tremendously thankful for my time in gunships, is that I had to deal with questions of life and death, but I did so in a community that was very familiar with those questions. Mm-hmm. And then when I dealt with those questions again in the Predator and later the Reaper, I had a pretty strong foundation to think about that with, you know, mentors and friends and some, frankly, peers of mine that had really done a lot in that world and had pretty mission forward, but sober ways of thinking about all that. And I'd like to believe I was able to bring some of that when I was a flight commander, then later to some of my people who were wrestling with those issues and really kind of didn't have a framework. And something, you know, we could potentially explore this a little bit later. I think it was a very important time for that because, frankly, the country was not in a great spot on thinking about the realities of the MQ-1 and MQ-9 crews. It was, you know, more likely to be a pop culture joke than it was to be, you know, something we dealt with seriously. And just frankly, I think the part that was a little bit hard about that for me is I was fine with myself. I knew who I was. You know, I knew why I was doing what I was doing. I was very at peace with that. But, you know, looking at really brave 20, 21, 22-year-olds who showed up at MEPS and did exactly what their country asked them to do, and then did not have the same kind of conversations with that country about those things they were asked to do. I think that was something that really kind of put a fire in my belly to say, hey, we need to improve the conversation on this. And so I ended up doing some writing. Some of it was fairly controversial. What was it? Somebody told me the only ASPJ article with, you know, threats of physical violence in the comment section. So picked at some wounds that we might not have been ready to have those conversations yet. But, you know, I think, you know, there was almost a 10-year story of how do we think about the fight? How do we think about dealing with killing? How do we have honest conversations on these things? And I would say for me, that started with trying to lead in the MQ1 and 9 community, but it really grew beyond that. And I realized the things we were wrestling with were just things that were foregrounded in the Predator and the Reaper, but they weren't unique to the Predator and the Reaper. All of us were dealing with distance killing. The distance just sort of changed. And so I think I'm actually profoundly thankful for my time there, because I think I was able to come to terms with some things, find some answers, that I was able to come back to, you know, some of these other communities, including the community I came from, and actually say, hey, this is what we found. These are some of the perspectives we'll need as we go forward and think about what's to come. And so I think there was this whole story arc to this where I'm very thankful that for the experiences I had, it gave me what I needed to lead where I was at. But then we found things that helped all those communities come to peace with lethal purpose and why we do that and how we do that.
Yeah.
Well,
that kind of brings us then to those who haven't read it. The article is frameworked through a series of AFSOC briefings that occurred between 2019 and 2021 that you named the Stone Soup briefing overall. And I'd like you to talk about the genesis of those briefings. I think you're touching on it. You've just touched on it now, kind of bringing that to the people who are currently in the fight. But go into some of the background to how that, what the reasons were, as much as you can tell us, the reasons for the briefing, you know, the reason why you all decided to do that and then to carry it forward. And then eventually, I think you said you briefed it at the highest levels. Is that right?
Yeah. And so I don't know if I'd say the highest levels, but definitely some of the leadership in AFSOC, we had the opportunity to have that conversation. And I'm really thankful to them on the ways that they were able to use that to guide the command through some hard conversations. And so, and I think, I believe that it actually made its way back into the broader MQ9 community and some communities from there. So it's something where, you know, I'd like to believe we were able to contribute to a lot of conversations. But yeah, like you said, there's a really interesting kind of genesis of how we got there. And I talk about this briefly in the article, but I think it goes all the way back to about 2011 when I was a flight commander. And I saw how killing changed people. I'd actually never seen it in myself, right? It's one of these things it's hard to just think about and to be a bit vulnerable on it. I think I had thought, you know, long and hard and, you know, a lot of thinking, a lot of prayer, a lot of that kind of stuff. I once again had a lot of great mentors who gave me some models to think about that. But I was actually a little bit surprised in the gunship how straightforward it was. And I kind of didn't know how to think about myself. I'm like, hey, this is a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. Is there something wrong with me? Hmm. You know, it was just all very matter of fact, right? You had good guys on the ground. There was a tactical engagement. It was all just frankly very straightforward of this is what needs to happen here. If this doesn't happen, this other bad things happens. And so therefore we do what we have to. 10 or 15 years later, you know, I think one of the things that reflecting on that we had in some of these conversations is that actually the initial act of killing affects everybody differently. And I think actually kind of freeing people to say, hey, look, there's nothing wrong with you, right? This is just this, everybody sees this different. Mm-hmm. And so anyways, I go to the MQ1 and at that point I'm leading as a flight commander. And I see in some of my crews that it changed them in certain ways. And I realized it probably had changed me in certain ways that I hadn't fully realized. So for instance, and some of this was sort of during the height of some of these surges and all this stuff. So you would go through periods of a lot of shooting and then other periods didn't have a lot of shooting. But one of the things that I started realizing is that it had become ubiquitous to us in certain ways that we kind of overlooked how significant it was that we were doing what we were doing, right? So one of the best examples, we had this amazing young couple that were both sensor operators. And there was a period where there was just a really long hot streak of kinetic engagements. And, you know, I think at some point, and there's this whole conversation on kill totals. Should we do that? Should we not do that? We can get into that conversation. But the short version on this was, if you look at the Stalingrad sniper, she interviews Eleanor Roosevelt for killing, you know, 100 people. Like we had, that couple had killed twice that, but we knew their names. I mean, they were just normal people. These were all the people we were talking to. And so the idea that we were actually in the middle of something very significant and historic was, it's just hard to see that from the outside. And the idea that that actually is had long-term consequences on how we saw ourselves and each other, I think was something that was kind of hard to see and, you know, easy to miss in the middle of this. And a lot of it was, you know, I mean, you're flying a whole lot and there's another mission tomorrow and there's another mission tomorrow and just no time to sit there and think about that. Mm-hmm. But that was the first time where I'm like, okay, I need to actually be rigorous and deliberate on how I think about this stuff and talk about this stuff because it's affecting people that I need to take care of. And then fast forward a couple of years, I went off to grad school after that, and I had some time to think about it. And frankly, I went through some things that I think I didn't quite know what I was going through when I was, I mean, once again, this is a weird time on how the nation talked about service in the Reaper, and kind of being in an academic environment at that time was interesting. I think I was told what the experience of a quote, drone operator, unquote, was very many times, told that my experience, my actual experience doing that actual job was not valid, that I needed to listen to all of the experts, unquote, drone operators, unquote, which is pretty fantastic. Yeah. I think that actually brought out a lot. I have a great friend who teaches at the Academy, and she actually pointed out to me that on how we thought about recognizing that, that, you know, the way that I was dealing with that was more emotional than I normally was. And I realized there was a whole lot there that I needed to sort of unpack about essentially the life we had lived. One of the things that came up in the Stone Soup brief that I think started for me there was the idea that the terms of sacrifice were different. Is that, you know, like what had happened in our lives and what had not happened in our lives. Extraordinarily, if I might be vulnerable, I'm extraordinarily lucky that I met my wife and I have, you know, Sam, it's amazing. But a lot of the years where that would have happened for me, you know, I'm basically flying airplanes 24/7, you know, in the middle of the desert. And so it was almost like, you know, in that conversation, I had sort of almost authorized to myself to say, there was, yes, what I gave up was very small compared to what some other people gave up. And that is absolutely 1,000% true, but it wasn't nothing. And yeah. that's stuff that I can actually think about and grieve and come to terms with and then move forward and then find joy in my life and say, hey, the things that we gave up were worth it because of the things we bought with that. That was this kind of solution to the equation that sort of gave me a lot of peace and joy. And that was something that, yeah, that just because your sacrifice was less doesn't mean it was nothing. Right. And that allows you to come to terms with it. And I think for a lot of us, you know, incomparable to what was happening to our comrades on the ground and our comrades in helicopters in these places that were, you know, in the heart of the West is, you know, the wars that we fought, but that we were able to offset that risk through just showing up day after day after day after day. But all of that showing up came at a cost. And I think if nothing else, that was a piece that I was able to bring back when I became a DO and then later a commander, say, hey, this is something that we carry together. This is something we take pride in, but it's something that we also sort of recognize the reality of it is worth doing what we do. It's worth giving what we give. We have to honor those who gave a lot more, but we also have to carry all this together. And in that we live our lives and move forward. And there's goodness in that. Yeah. So sorry, very long road. Once again, sort of writing the paper was kind of like this is all of it unpacked a lot of things.
That's part of the process. It's great.
So I come back as DO and we had FSOC has this great program called PODIF, which is Preservation of the Forces Family. So we had a counselor. She's amazing. Her name's Karen. And she had actually lost a loved one in the course of these wars. And so it was interesting talking to her about this because she would hang out with the crews. She would go on the command center floor. She would watch the shots. The crews really trusted her because of her understanding of loss, like that she didn't look away from the things that we had to do. There were a lot of great counselors I've known, but very few of them were willing to actually, you know, get their hands dirty and get in the middle of it and actually see all the things that we were seeing. And I really appreciated that she did that. You know, she and I had this great conversation as we thought about how do we take care of the crews? What is it they're going through? How does this affect them? How do we take care of them? And all that stuff. So that led to a paper that ended up in Lawfare, and that was called Avengers in Wrath. But really what that looked at was that if you read Grossman, and Grossman's fantastic. I've had a personal conversation with him about that. I think very highly of him. But if you read Grossman, his original model says that essentially the closer you get physically to a target, the harder it is to kill them. Mm-hmm. And we realized that we needed to probably update two different parts of that model to understand what the crews were seeing. And one of them is that it wasn't physical distance. It was cognitive distance. It was, I may be within 500 miles pressing go on a cruise missile, but I'm hitting grid squares. I don't actually see what I'm hitting. So even though I'm closer at 500 miles than I am at 5,000 miles, my experience of that is actually not nearly as visceral. So the idea on cognitive distance is basically how do you experience the humanity of your target? Because that's potentially what makes it traumatic to take that life. And so that was one piece of the model that we looked at a lot, which was, hey, it is the way in which they're experiencing their targets. It is all of those sort of human touch points of, I see my target acting like a human. I have a high enough resolution to sort of, they look like somebody I could know. They are doing the kind of things, the family life sort of things that I would know or like does. And those were the things that eventually became challenging on executing the mission. And so the idea that what we really needed was to update that from physical distance to cognitive distance. And once again, primacy goes to, you know, if somebody is in sort of ground combat range. Cognitive distance is extremely high. You have all forms of sensory encounter there. But really what we were talking about was a distance between 5 miles, 500 miles, and 5,000 miles. That those ranges weren't really all that helpful. It was more, what were you doing? And obviously that doesn't address risk and reciprocity and all that stuff. But the second thing that we realized, and this was actually the really, I don't know if it was puzzling, but it was actually probably the most helpful piece out of the model, is that in Grossman's version, you're encountering an adversary that you don't want to have to kill. That's a complex statement in and of itself. But the idea is that this is a Christmas truce. You know, this is World War One, and this is these are the people that you wish you could just sit down and have a beer with. You know, I mean, and I think it's super, even in the story of Hal Moore and Yadrang Valley and We Were Soldiers, right? The end of that story is that he's there with the other general walking through the battlefield. And the thing that we realized is, like, that will never happen ever with Zarqawi. Zarqawi was a monster who used drills to torture children. He does not, should not ever be near anybody ever. There's no version of this where we walk those roads with him and talk about what happened here. And I mean, same with Baghdadi, and, you know, we can go through the list of names. And that was the big realization for us, is that for certain of these targets, it's the better you get to know them, the more you are okay with this. You're like, I understand what's happening here, right? I understand what this person is doing to other people. And I experience the humanity of my target, but I experience the humanity of their victims. And the humanity of their victims weighs so heavily on me that that side of the scale is overbalancing whatever I feel about the humanity of my target. It's not that I don't feel anything for the humanity of my target, but I know exactly why I'm doing it. And I have no problem doing it. And I think it was that moment of moral clarity that was actually particularly helpful for us, was we're like, hey, this isn't about insulating you from this. It's actually about giving you the tools to encounter the reality and to endorse it yourself, but also giving you enough rest to think about it, right? And so that was that idea of, we're not helping you by taking you away from this. In fact, if we take you away from this, you don't really know why you're doing it. We actually need to walk you into what we're doing and see if you can endorse a moral logic with us. And what we found was the crews could. In fact, it helped them a lot. And then we also owed it to the crews to give them, you know, rest and space to decompress, right? And this is something we certainly did not do well with our remote warriors, but I think with some of the deployment cycles we had, we kind of didn't do that well with anybody. So I don't know that that was specific to that. So with Karen and I, we were able to get the first half of that equation, which was essentially the target knowledge and the how do we actually give the crews the analytical tools to do this. One of the things that I was really proud about the community doing was we ended up getting to a deploy to dwell cycle that actually gave them the other side of the equation, which is the ability to, I think one of the ways we put it is, if you're never more than 72 hours from killing somebody for years on end, that's not the normal experience of American life. And so it starts normalizing death in ways that make it hard to relate to people, frankly. Yeah. And I am very, very thankful that kind of follow on generations in that community and hopefully all other communities like cyber and et cetera, where we're potentially dealing with death, that we don't say just because you're physically here doesn't mean you don't need the space to actually think about what's going on. And so in the middle of this, I started briefing this to the crews because I thought this is a useful thing to do as a commander. And what I found was actually there's a tremendous demand function for that brief outside of the MQ community. And I realized that, I mean, we had crafted these findings to help MQ crews walk through it, but we realized actually everybody needed this. This is not just about remote killing. It was, or rather another way to say it is, we were all doing remote killing. The question was just how remote. And so a lot of us were doing, and obviously that doesn't apply to, you know, battlefield airmen and, you know, a lot of people who had dramatically different experiences. But at that point, that's where it started turning into the stone soup briefing, is that we found that there was a demand function. And so, I mean, AFSOC's a fairly small command, half AFSOC's at Hurlburt Field. And I'm like, hey, we could just have this conversation and we could reach out to, you know, enough crews that this becomes common knowledge. And so the thought was, through enough briefings, I don't know that it would change the culture per se, but we could at least open the conversation. And so, yeah, I just started briefing it and had a lot of great friends who were squadron commanders and a lot of communities there. And that became the Stone Soup Brief. It really started with that original article, but it grew into something much bigger. And when I look at the content now, I mean, maybe 30% was the ideas we started with. The vast majority of it was really ideas that, you know, weren't mine. They were just the community trying to work through and deal with what we were dealing with. And so I think it became something that we all put together that kind of helped us all navigate it. And one of the things I'm particularly proud about, you know, AFSOC kinetic community on this was, there was a growing understanding that a lot of other people that were adjacent to the killing actually experienced the killing pretty directly. And so without going too far into specifics, there were some intel communities that I think were absolutely wrestling with this kind of stuff, that were for whom it was very up close and personal, where they had through the same means of personal connection to these targets. And I think we had underserved them as part of this conversation because they weren't pressing the last red button. So we assumed, you know, they were fine. And the reality is they weren't. And you know, they were working through it the same way we all were. But actually, I think one of the greatest successes of the briefing was to include them in the conversation and say, hey, let's carry this all together. This isn't ops v. intel. This is all of us. And what's important here is that we preserve as much of our humanity as we can, but we do the things that need to be done. And that's a problem we'll all try to solve together. So that became the Stone Soup brief. I think we briefed it enough times that it became mainstream. And that's what brought us here. And so when you put out the call for the article, it was a chance for me to revisit it with a couple of years distance. It was amazing unpacking it one more time.
I'm glad that you did. I was going to say a friend of mine, she was a targeteer and she suffered terribly from that experience. And she was just the targeteer. She was not pulling the trigger. And so it's good that you included them in that. In the article, you talked about the ideas. You said a third of it was what was originally there. And then the other two thirds kind of emerged a la Stone Soup. You lay out in the article, you talk about the findings, changing character of war, nature of sacrifice, military profession, relationship between killing and identity. And you've touched on some of these things already, but if there's anything more you'd like to say about how those ideas kind of developed bones and sinew and flesh and blood on moving forward in that discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say that really the way by which that happened was that you'd have a brief and it really depended on the community, but you would have one or two people that, I mean, the way that they were trying to deal with this is that they kind of presented as hostile. And I think in retrospect, they weren't being hostile. They were just trying to deal with these things. And this was a way they were simultaneously trying to connect, but also kind of trying to test to say, hey, are you safe? And frankly, I don't really know what I think on this. So saying these words out loud, you know, I'm going to say them in such a way where I can sort of walk back from them. But people brought up some really kind of heartrending, you know, questions, right? I mean, that it was, I mean, questions that were really hard. And this one actually got significantly more difficult. But one of them was, what are we doing in Afghanistan? I mean, that's a very, very hard question to talk about, right? And so there's a slide in the deck that sort of talks about, you know, sort of individual morality versus strategic outcomes. I really had to wrestle with that. Despite how that ended, you know, there was a moral purpose in doing that, right? There was one side that was throwing acid in girls' faces for going to school, and there was another side that wasn't. And so for all of the flaws of that other side, there was a side that was the right side, I believe. Whether or not it was actually possible that that could have turned out differently, is it, to me, I realize that's a separate question. I'm not responsible for that. But what I am responsible for is knowing that in my heart of hearts, like what I am doing is contributing to the right side of this conflict, and that whatever I'm doing it rightly. But it was a little bit hard to basically say, I don't know how this thing ends, but I know what we did. I know what we did. And I know that applaud those who did the things that they did so that there could be some hope of that turning out differently, as long as it was within ethical and moral boundaries. And so, I mean, I think it is a hard story for a lot of us. I want to kind of dive into that a little bit. Let me circle back to something in the brief and then we'll circle back. One of the things that we started looking at was there's actually a neuropsych component to the brief. And I'm, you know, if I can sort of double down on how helpful the operational psychologists were as part of this. One of the things that was very useful was this idea of mirror neurons, that there is actually a physical topography to the brain. And that, you know, if you sprain a leg, we don't call you weak for not running on your sprained leg, right? There is mechanics to how your brain works. It's not just a black box. There's a tendency to say anything that's going on inside the, and I say the brain instead of the mind specifically, right? But we don't really deal with that particularly well, I think, because, well, it's complex and you can see what a sprained ankle looks like. But one of the things that they brought up that was really powerful, that was something we kept coming back to in the briefings, was this idea of mirror neurons, that intimacy and killing are tied together in ways that are complex, especially the forms of killing that we did, which was very based in sort of very specific personal knowledge of the target, where aspects of their daily pattern of life and the things they would do in the course of a day was in many cases how we found, you know, vulnerabilities where they would give us targeting windows. And knowing that is not, you know, abstract. It's like that is connecting to another human being to understand how they live their life so that I can use that against them, which is actually a very unnatural act in peacetime. That would be not something a healthy person would ever do, but that's exactly what we needed to do during wartime to be successful. And so I think that idea of mirror neurons, that there is actually a topography of the brain, there are these mechanisms for intimacy, and that it was super important to keep people connected to each other so that the normal mechanisms for intimacy were working properly. And they were strongly embedded in community so that they could take very small portions of their brain and weaponize it to do what we needed to do. I think that was something that just kept coming back up. And a little bit to circle back, because I think it is worth talking about. The societal discussion has gotten far better on RPAs, but I think this is actually one of the early tragedies, is that the thing that keeps you rightly aligned is actually connection to your neighbors and your friends and your country and all these things when you're doing that kind of work. And unfortunately, when people were treated as if they were, you know, either a joke or a, you know, or something that was monstrous, right? I mean, you start losing the ability to get those mirror neurons to anchor against that. And one of the things that we actually found is that there was extremely strong sense of loyalty on the part of the crews for the people on the ground we were protecting, because part of that is just natural, but part of that was people were just looking for somebody to be anchored to. And so I know writing the part about, you know, Battle of Kobani and that kind of stuff, I mean, there are people we never met in person, but we felt passionately. That person matters to me deeply. The loss of that person matters to me deeply. There's obviously some, you know, individuals that, you know, happened part of the ISIS campaign that were people felt the same way about. Without going into specifics, but the idea of connectedness was something we absolutely kept coming back to. But the idea that there was a topography to the human brain that could be thought of as an organ, I think was extremely useful because it basically said, hey, this isn't about are you weak or strong. And in many cases, one of the things we came back to was one of these themes that I think was really powerful is the need to show each other grace and to show ourselves grace. You know, it sounds squishy, it sounds whatever, but I think if it's a physical wound, we're great at that, right? If a mortar bomb goes off near you, nobody's surprised when your flesh does not repel mortar frag. Obviously, that's what happens, right? I mean, that's what a mortar does. And this is one of some of the particularly monstrous stuff that like ISIS and, you know, Al-Qaeda would do, and the Taliban. I mean, I don't want to let them off the hook. But they would create these situations where they would put an innocent person in the line of fire, and then you would have this impossible situation of, you know, hey, do I stop that VBID? I know it's probably somebody innocent driving that thing, but X number of people are going to die, or X number, you know, one person's going to die, or one person plus X number of people are going to die. And there's no version of this where I can save that person. And so you have to take the shot, right? There's no way not to. It's not, you know, the math is what the math is, but you have to live with it now. And so when I think about that, I'm like, that's a moral IED. That's a picture that's burned into somebody's mind they have to live with forever. Our adversaries did that on purpose. Yep. And so when we look at that and say, hey, you have to suffer in silence, can you imagine somebody being hit by mortar frag saying, oh, sorry, you just got to take care of that yourself. Nobody wants to hear about that.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be crazy, right? We would be coming alongside, we'd be doing everything we possibly could. But when it is this mental wound that is the expected value of a tactic like that, you just can't see that and be fine with it. That's just not what that is. And so I think the idea is once we talked about it that way is we're like, your enemy did this to your comrade for the specific reason of getting into their head. They wounded your friend. What is your instinct when your friend is wounded? If it was physical, you would come alongside him. And we started getting to the point of like, hey, when it's mental, it's the same thing. Like, this is something that was done to us. This was an adversary who not only didn't try to protect civilians, they actively used civilians as, you know, in horrific ways. And so I think there was this idea of, hey, this is actually about grace, but grace is towards combat outcomes. Grace is just doing for your friends when it comes to a mental wound what you would do for them when it comes to a physical wound. And then to some extent, that was showing ourselves grace and saying, letting us unpack this stuff. It's like, hey, the things I've seen, you know, I'm not speaking for me. I mean, there's across community, right? Yeah. But the things that we had seen are things you can't unsee. I mean, there are things that if you sort of just tell any normal person who hasn't experienced these things, it sounds terrible. And it's just, on one hand, you can't sit around just saying, hey, this is so terrible all the time. But on the other hand, you just can't pretend that it didn't happen. And so I think that idea of grace is not weakness. In fact, grace is how we build strength, and strength is what we'll need for the next fight. Grace is power. Mm-hmm. And grace allows us to pursue our purpose.
Yeah.
I think that was powerful.
Yeah. I think that leads to my last question here on what your message to three groups of people. I see a message to people who have retired from the military and are dealing with the long war and the scars of the long war and their memories about that. And then there's a message to people who are still active duty, who are still fighting the current fights, wherever they happen to be. And then to the future military members, the people we have to recruit, and we're having an increasingly difficult time across all the services to do that, and how you apply the lessons from the long war to make better outcomes and communicate to people strategies for dealing with the things that they potentially have to deal with. So I guess that was not phrased quite as a question, but if you could talk about that.
No, I think that's a wonderful breakdown. So if I can unpack that a little bit, I almost think there's two groups of the people who are in right now, and I'll talk about that in a second because it circles back to this, what happened after Afghanistan question, which is frankly kind of what I'm wrestling with right now a little bit. And I think there is a narrative of purpose and hope that came out of that, at least for me in reflecting on it. And honestly, that was probably the hardest part of writing this is I'm like, where am I at now? I'm comfortable with what we did. I'm not happy with how it ended, but, and I know what we're looking at right now, but can I essentially tie those threads together in a way that brings coherence to that story? And so I think that's different depending on what age you are in the force and whether or not you're likely to, you know, be on the battlefield if something bad happens in the future, or if you're the people building the force that that group is going to inherit, because I think both of us have to deal with that slightly differently. But we'll come back to that in a second. You said that very well, is that first group, you know, the people who have served and have since, you know, retired or separated. And I remember, I think the idea is there is a thank you for what you gave. I know none of this was clear. I know none of this had an easy ending. I know that a lot of this didn't turn out the way we hoped. I guess when we actually take stock of it, you know, the lives that we lived, I mean, ISIS was monstrous. We were afraid of that taking over the whole region and potentially, you know, having, I mean, imagine if that had rolled into Saudi and global energy supply and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, once again, it's easy to look back and say that would never happen. But I mean, when we were in the middle of, when it's like 13, 14, 15, nobody knew where this thing was going to end. And I mean, even at that point, it's just absolute humanitarian catastrophe. And somehow, you know, we were able to end that thing in its cradle before it, something as nasty as that got, you know, any further than it did. So there's so many possible worlds that it's hard to think through all of them, especially because this just wasn't World War II, right? There wasn't some signature signing ceremony thing. But even in that, so much good happened. There's an article I read. It was actually a Afghan music student. He was in New York. And it basically was this Thank You America story. And he's like, I know how all this turned out, but you bought me 20 years. And with those 20 years, this is the future that you bought me. And so there's almost this like American expectation that the story just ends well. And I think that even though, especially in that case, it didn't, there were a lot of things we bought for a lot of people and that's worth something and that we should celebrate that. And when we take a look at Iraq, I mean, that story also could have ended very differently. I think that, that the fact that Northern Iraq was able to repel an ISIS invasion and actually, like, that's a big deal. And that wouldn't have happened without all the things that everybody gave. And then think about, you know, Al-Shabaab and some of these things. I mean, you talk about a absolutely monstrous ideology. The fact that that's been held in check, you know, Boko Haram, you name it. For all of these activities, there were really, really evil, monstrous things that were held in check. And that bought people time, and time buys you life. And there are a whole lot of people around the world that, I mean, yes, there were collateral damage. You know, this is a complex story. But I think at the end of the day, and I'm not trying to be jingoistic about this, I think at the end of the day, what was bought is worth contemplating. So I think there's also a big piece on what did we let down? The conversation on invisible wounds is, I think, in a very good spot now, but it was not in a very good spot 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And certain communities, like you talk about the intelligence community, that I think were massively underserved by the modalities of that conversation. And so the thing that worries me a little bit, and the thing where I think we do need to think about deliberate interventions, is who are the people that slipped through the cracks, that kind of fell out of our orbit before we figured this stuff out? Because I think we owe them something. We asked them to sacrifice. They did sacrifice. And I don't know that we always kept our end of the bargain of when the terms of their sacrifice didn't match what our two-hour movies about what war is look like. And, you know, I just, how many years, how many marriages, how many other things were given up, you know, in the course of that. And I mean, those are real things. So I think for that group is finding some way to affirm that story, finding some way to actually account not only for the bad things, but for the good things, and saying, hey, this was complex, but part of that complexity is this was not just 100% a catastrophe on all fronts always. Things happened that mattered for people. And there were a whole lot of people who gave in various forms that allowed people we had never met in various places to live lives that were better than what would have happened to them had it been at the whim of Boko Haram or, you know, Al-Shabaab. So on and so forth. But yeah, I think we also need to think about how do we take an inventory? How do we find all the people that we probably owed more to and come back and say, how do we walk alongside you now that we can name these things?
Yep.
I think that the younger group who is thinking about joining the military and thinking about taking lives and things, I see a whole lot of things through a Ukraine lens right now, just because this is kind of what, it's not total war from our perspective, but if I'm the Ukrainians, I probably feels a lot like total war to me.
Yeah.
And so there's almost a change. There was a time in the middle of the GWAT where You know, I remember the story on Maven, which was, oh, we just found out we're doing artificial intelligence for the DoD and the DoD is icky. And so therefore, I'm not going to show up to work, which is a bit ironic when people are making search engines for the PRC, but whatever.
Yes.
You know, but it's a very different moment right now. I mean, you have Eric Schmidt, who is leading venture capital firms of a lot of great Americans, some in uniform, most not, trying to help a country of free people do their best to fight an enemy that just casually does war crimes as a, you know, as a
matter of course. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so there is this story that is starting to change that actually I think is very important. And one group of people that we owe far more to than we were ever able to admit as a country was Vietnam veterans, obviously. And I think what's interesting is that even in the complexities of this, we as a country have done far better than the conversation that happened back then. And I think that's an important place to start with. We always have a hard time with complex wars. I mean, this is just the nature of our society. We want things to be simple. These things weren't simple. But I think one of the realizations is we did a lot better on this one than we did before. That was, I think, a national tragedy, how we treated people who served because we asked them to serve. And then we treated them with contempt because of the terms of their service. But
yeah, and also didn't help them. Not just contempt from a media standpoint, but help them figure out tools or help them deal with what they dealt with. I mean, my dad is a Vietnam vet and there were no tools. They were just suffer in silence.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think one thing that makes me optimistic on this is like, I even look at, there's a funny shirt out there that says All Drones Movie Sucks, which is But I look at the trajectory of it and like all of them have gone from absolutely totally ridiculous to semi-serious, realizing there's people who do this. And so even on that story, we've kind of grown up a lot, which is a little bit crazy. When you look at the Ukrainians and they've got, you know, a song about the Bayraktar because it was one of the...
Really? Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. That's funny.
And if you think about the moment, though, I mean, they're getting crushed and it's like this one little not very good small UAS. No offense to...
Yeah, to the Turks, I know.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, it's running around and it's actually doing something meaningful to try to stop this Russian wave of advance. And I'm like, something changed here where the same kind of technology, we're like, oh, icky, bad, whatever. We're like, you have Ukrainians basically singing pop songs about these things because it's one of the, you know, it was one of the things that was actually making a difference. And so, you know, then you got a generation of people flying small UASs and all this stuff. So I think to the younger generation, I think the toolkit they'll have going into this, if heaven forbid that there's actually some form of conflict, you know, all of us hope and pray that the world does not go that direction. But, you know, I think for those who are going to stand vigil and make sure it doesn't go that direction, I think A, there's a much better toolkit. I think about, I mean, one of the things that was interesting, I've studied a little bit, is think about the culture of proto red flag type stuff. And, you know, 82, 83 is that you have a bunch of people coming from Vietnam who have air to air experiences in Vietnam. But the next generation, kind of the toolkits they inherited because the learning from Vietnam was very incomplete about killing, is that there was this simultaneous sort of, I don't really know what they experienced. So killing is either going to be, are they going to celebrate it or like, we don't know what to deal with it. And then those are all kind of wrong responses. And so I think what's interesting is that that generation is walking into a toolkit of combat veterans who have done killing, who can give a unapologetic, mission focused, I know what I did, I know why I did it, but here is how to think about it. So you get this sober toolkit that I think is going to be really, really important, that we need to be able to capture these lessons and hand to that generation. We're like, hey, look, you know, you don't glorify killing, but you also don't look away from it. These are the distinctives of the profession. And we can look at that and we can talk about it seriously without having to have unhealthy responses do what we need to do. So I think that piece is good. Yeah, I think the fact that there isn't nearly the level of national trauma that there was after Vietnam is very important. And I think really the resilience we can sort of hand to them is, hey, you have a whole generation in front of you that has seen, not in the total war sense, not in the mass casualty sense, but in the like, hey, we have seen this for a long time and we have something to give to you so that you're ready. And then I want to go to that last piece, that group that you had mentioned, is the people who are in uniform right now. And I think there's almost a, and maybe I'm templating my own experience on this too much, but this keeps coming back to the Afghanistan thing for me, is how does the Afghanistan story turn into other stories? There's this great book called Prodigal Soldiers, who sort of talk about how the people who came out of Vietnam with those experiences actually go into Desert Storm, and they're able to sort of take what they learned and apply it in ways that obviously turned out very differently. And I think there's something to that. And one of the questions for me is, how many of us are at a point in our careers, and I'm sort of speaking about myself, where I'm not going to be in a direct combat role probably in anything that happens in the future because my line flying days are, unfortunately, I love flying airplanes, but unfortunately, that's probably not going to be my primary duty if something were to happen.
And so for me, I realized I'm never going to get that absolution of like the things we couldn't do there. I'm going to come back and use that to win the next war, right? And I think there is almost something that is a vindication in that, which is the things I couldn't do, I'm going to do somewhere else. But for us, I think the thing that's very important is just to come to terms with that and say, hey, there is so much we can hand to the next generation who is going to be looking this thing in the face personally. And how do we do everything we possibly can to prepare them? And then if we're in a position to lead them, then we are leading them in the knowledge of these things as they're looking this thing in the eye. And I think that's a charge for us. But I think, you know, for the people we were leading that are going to be the flight commanders and the squadron commanders and the flight chiefs and the SCLs, you know, if a fight were to happen, I look at that generation, I'm unbelievably proud. I mean, they have come out of this. They didn't necessarily see the, you know, the really dark times that we sort of grew up in, which is good because there wasn't much great that came out of that. But they saw what we were able to build on top of that. And then they were able to take that to the next level. And I think if I'm my I think if I'm our adversaries and I'm looking at a force like that, that is tempered by combat, thoughtful about these things, able to lead in these things, I think that is something pretty fearsome. So I'm extremely proud of that generation. And there's one last piece that I think, and once again, I still have more thinking to do on this, and I don't have a clean answer, but I have seen something. One of my friends, he's actually out at Maxwell with you, Mark Jacobson, is an you know, amazing guy. Mm-hmm. And so he did everything he could to help Syrians in 2015 on his own. He has an amazing book about it. Then I look at Pineapple Express, right? And there's this thread that basically says, hey, when we couldn't do what we needed to do at work, we actually took it upon ourselves through our own initiative.
Right.
We were able to actually make some of these things right. And so I think about the group of people, there's some really amazing people that came together that says, hey, even in my day job, I can't get these people out of here. Well, I'm going to go home. I'm going to call my friend at Raytheon and they're going to turn ATAC into CivTAC. And then we're going to figure out how to get these people out. Mm-hmm. And then that happened. This is something that is amazing to me. Is I'm like, this is not something you get out of an authoritarian regime. This is something that nations do, which is I have a moral obligation. I'm going to do everything I can. Then I don't know how whether or not the whole story ends well, I'm going to try to do right by as many people as I can. And I think there was this shining moment of this sort of heart that brought us into these fights in the first place, trying to make a difference. You know, there, you know, all of us, well, I don't know, I can only speak for myself, but I believe, you know, at least most of us showed up with a high degree of idealism on how this whole thing was going to turn out, right? Mm-hmm. And what Pineapple Express shows me is that idealism is still there, right? Like we still believed, even, you know, against all hope that we could do something. What's amazing to me on that, and we talked about this desire for vindication and absolution, that no warrior wants to leave on a note of defeat. That is something that's really, really hard, right? And frankly, makes the rest of this stuff harder to deal with. And so, you know, from Pineapple Express, one of the things that was absolutely fascinating was, you know, the sort of outpouring of support when Ukraine started. Because I mean, once again, you had, you know, I spent some time in that region and, you know, the choices that the Putins of the world have made on launching missiles at schools and things. I mean, this is, frankly, to me, it reads a lot like the choices Al-Qaeda and ISIS were making.
Yeah.
And so it kind of brings me back to like, hey, this is different terms. This looks like conventional war, but this is kind of the same heart. And so there's this thing, and perhaps it was actually, this is a connection between this older and younger generation, is we did want to jump in. And there was vindication and absolution in it, I think, at least for me, but I think for a lot of us, is we're like, this is the thing that we wanted to do that we couldn't do. And we're going to try to make a difference here. And so I think you see, you know, everything from obviously there's a huge conversation on volunteer support with like on multiple levels. That's really interesting, you know, where you see a lot of people playing a role in that. I've seen people just do amazing stuff at work with the authorities they were given where, I mean, this is, none of this was for an OPR bullet or any of that. Like this is all because it was to do. And I saw so many people just go above and beyond because it was a compelling calling and because they could actually show what was possible. And the thing that was amazing about this to me is that some of this was a great power war deck, right? That kind of stuff, you know, the classic, you know, how does a jammer work against a radar and the kind of things we didn't air-to-air missile stuff that we didn't have to worry about in ISIS land, but with caveats. But it was that spirit of innovation that says, I'm not going to let the bad guys out innovate me. I'm going to go fast. And it turns out the free nations are really, really good at that because we found willing partners in the Ukrainians who also wanted to go fast. And there is this story about what free nations could do, you know, in the face of an authoritarian regime. And so I think there's this like almost like hope is kindled. And then the first part of the article, the reason I think that was the rawest part for me, because that was me actually starting to connect that thread in my mind of what am I doing right now versus what did I do then? And is there coherence? Mm-hmm. And I think there was this moment of hope of saying, hey, actually, the deck that is being played there is everything that we learned from what was done to us and how we learned to counter it, combined with what we know about the big fight. And you put those two together in a spirit of combat innovation and partnership and human flourishing, all the things that authoritarian regimes just don't do real well. Mm-hmm. And it made a difference. And, you know, like, God willing, all of that, who knows how that ends. But against all odds, the fact that this, you know, the fact that they're holding the line is pretty amazing, you know.
Yeah.
And I think when I look at that and I look at, you know, potential threats around the world, I'm like, there is some recipe here where our scars become our strength. And we take these things we learned, not only in mindset, but also in just tactics and thinking and moving quickly and moving out and drawing fire and all of this stuff. We put that together with a renewed seriousness about the, you know, great power fight. You put those together and that's a hand that you can't beat. So this is where I think there is a story of hope that I think is a good note to end on. Yeah. And it is kind of that prodigal stories or prodigal soldier story is like, I believe we found all the things we need to win in this complex and winding, meandering story without a clean ending that we all lived. I think we found all the things that we need to be able to succeed, you know, ideally in deterring and if necessary, fighting the next one. And so I think that's a point of hope that I found in the course of writing this.
Well, it's very introspective and insightful and revealing and all those really important things. It definitely made me think. I know it's made a lot of people, other people think. We really appreciate you parsing through this and putting something together for that issue. It means a lot. And I think it definitely has longevity, you know, as the ideas turn and people learn to come to grips with how they feel and move forward and deal with the things that war brings in the future. I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast today. And I direct people to the article. And I really appreciate your time. I know that's probably not an easy thing to talk about. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And once again, thank you for putting together the article and sort of giving me the opportunity to kind of explore all of this. I think this is huge. So thank you.